This is going to sound trite, but there is an honesty slash integrity that seems to be common to people who work with their hands for enjoyment. We both recognize that woodworking is something that people will do for decades, if not for their entire life. We both assume our customers are coming back at some point and do everything to ensure that happens. These two refined companies, Lee Nielsen and Veritas, are like if a town had two excellent restaurants on either side of it, and the chefs loved each other's cooking in a way that it inspired them to make new, better dishes themselves. Lee said, "At the same time as we compete, the two firms are really quite complementary. I often describe Lee Nielsen as classical, where we're jazz. Tom's line is based on executing the time-tested designs of Stanley Tools to a quality level that Stanley never achieved. Our designs are based on a reboot for each plane, taking into account changes in methods of work, available materials, and the capabilities of modern manufacturing." I was very charmed by this generosity of spirit that is reflected in the tools fashioned by these folks. When Deneb started working for Lee Nielsen 14 years ago, there were 30 to 40 employees. Today there are 100, and they make more than 350 individual tools. Now, this circumstance is peculiar given the fact that they are completely committed to quality over profit. Normal business sense would lead such an outfit to look for places where corners could be cut or lesser material substituted, in the way that so many plastics have been introduced into your average automobile, for example. Thomas Lee Nielsen launched his business with a burning desire to fabricate hand tools the way they ought to be made, and he's not about to forget it. Before I left the tool show, I asked Matt Kenny for an official quote for my book, and he didn't have much trouble coming up with a firm opinion, almost as though he reads books. "We should count ourselves fortunate that in the late 1970s, Thomas recognized a need for better hand tools, and that he was audacious enough to start making hand planes to meet it. And we should admire the determination, focus, and force of personality it must have taken to develop those early efforts into the company that Lee Nielsen Toolworks is today." On top of such a commitment to quality, Lee Nielsen Tools also carry a 100% lifetime guarantee. That an American company could grow in this way while maintaining an inarguable level of quality and customer satisfaction thrills me to no end. By the way, I should point out that when they say "Made in America," that is completely what they mean. I was not aware until Deneb informed me that a retail item requires only 60% of its labor to be performed on U.S. soil in order to receive that coveted label, which feels like bullshit to me. So much mediocrity has seeped into the regulation of our American integrity that even "Made in America" is only 60% true? So some CEO can make a buck or millions of them. How many of our American products are being mostly fabricated in Asia, or Mauritius, or the Philippines, only to have the shoelaces installed in Alabama so we can pay premium prices? Robin Lee added, "A healthy manufacturing base is the foundation of a solid economy. It keeps much of the value generated and the resulting employment at home. If your friends and neighbors are out of work, you have no one to sell your product to." In a world where so many commercial strings are being pulled in curtain chambers beyond our control, one place we can exert our power is in the open market, namely where our money goes. I can think of no better place to spend my American dollars than on the tools and the people of Lee Nielsen Toolworks. Chapter 14. The Boatwright, Nat Benjamin. One theme that has repeatedly bobbed to the surface in this book is boat building. From Theodore Roosevelt to Frederick Douglass to Thomas Lee Nielsen, everyone seems to have taken a swing at building wooden boats. Even your author is not exempt. Should one choose to pursue the craft of woodworking, it's only a matter of time before your matriculation runs squarely into the prospect of either boat building or luthery, making stringed musical instruments such as guitars and ukuleles, if you're the right kind of goofy. You've conquered all the ways to join wooden components at every combination of angles, with or without fasteners, with a mastery of square, level, and plumb. You have spent Gladwell's 10,000 hours on sanding alone. Your fancy now begins to ponder the daunting undertaking of objects that contain no straight lines whatsoever. Impossible? Definitely. Still, you subscribe to Wooden Boat Magazine and drift through the pages, finding yourself growing half erect, ladies too, at the merest advertisements for spar varnish. Although you've been using it your entire life, you only just now realize that the spar in that nomenclature refers to the horizontal wooden poles on the mast of a sailing rig. When you begin listening to Stan Rogers' Barrett's Privateers on repeat, it's over. Notify your significant other that he or she should stock up on good reading material, because you'll be building a wooden boat. When I was overcome by this particular spell in 2001 or so, I was at the airport and I realized I needed a book for my flight. As luck would have it, I happily happened upon a paperback in the doorway of the bookstore entitled simply, Wooden Boats. Fantastic! I devoured it on the plane and learned about a pair of wooden boat builders named Nat Benjamin and Ross Gannon on the island of Martha's Vineyard off the coast of Massachusetts. Their story was as fanciful as any fairy tale to this aspiring woodworker who grew up in the very landlocked region of Illinois. Unless this riveting book by Michael Ruhlman was a fabrication, there were actually men and women living in this great land of ours, building boats out of wood, using tools, know-how, and, of course, gumption. With this hard proof that the construction of a seaworthy wooden hull was not beyond the realm of possibility, I sallied forth in my own small endeavors, which have to date produced a watertight 4-foot cradle / tender, and 2 18-foot canoes. I have mentioned it elsewhere, but it bears repeating. Traveling across the water in a boat that one has fabricated oneself holds an eldritch magic that cannot be described. There is wizardry embroidered into the whole of the act. As the years went by, I saw successively greater triumphant achievements from Gannon and Benjamin Marine Railway, the name of Ross and Nat's company, in Wooden Boat Magazine, as well as in a beautiful coffee table book entitled simply Schooner by Tom Dunlop, which details the construction of Rebecca, a magnificent 60-foot craft, and then my favorite piece on them, the documentary Charlotte, from Jeffrey Kusama Hinty. Highly recommended if you enjoy things like life and beauty. Basically, by that point, Nat and Ross had become, to me at least, the rock stars of American wooden boat builders. Now, I have traditionally found that the greater the craftsperson, the stronger the self-deprecation, and Nat was no exception. His response to my emailed request for an interview included, "You're really scraping the bottom to consider the reprobates at Gannon and Benjamin." I took my two talented maker friends, Jimmy DiResta and Taylor Forrest, with me to Martha's Vineyard to meet reprobate number one. Even a couple days after Christmas, Vineyard Haven Harbor had several beautiful antique wooden yachts bobbing in evidence as we came in on the ferry. We met Nat at the shop, also known as the railway, named thus for the actual steel rails that run 50 yards into the water, upon which a boat of a weight up to dozens of tons can be rolled into and out of the harbor's water. It was amazing to see in person the old barn in which I had remotely viewed and read of so much mastery. As in all my favorite shops, the tools and machines were ancient and brown and heavy, thickly squatting upon their cast iron bases. Our foursome immediately launched into the classic shop geek rap, admiring exceptional examples of bandsaw and planer and lathe. Pre-World War II. A good boat shop will have a gargantuan bandsaw, known as a ship's saw, upon which one can cut a curve on an enormously long and massive timber, like for the keel of a boat, while simultaneously slanting the piece through the saw on what's called a rolling bevel. Considering the modern cost of the tropical hardwoods preferred for such a task, such as angelique, it's a cut that must be undertaken with a lot of care and no small amount of gumption. Jimmy and Taylor and I admired the ship saw in Nat's shop as he apologized for Ross's absence. "He doesn't come out on weekends," he explained. "Sounds like a smart family man." Nat said, "You should most definitely include him in your assessment. He has been my business partner, co-founder, and friend for 40-plus years, and is equally blameworthy for the relative success and accomplishments of our boatyard." The pair felt very fortunate to have secured the somewhat ramshackle shop, read charming, not only because it sits right on the water, in the perfect location to execute their watery railway transactions, but also because the site very nearly became a fast food restaurant instead. When Gannon and Benjamin met in the early 70s as fellow wooden boat geeks and gradually determined that they would like to establish a groovy, casual shop where wooden boat enthusiasts like themselves could repair and maintain their charismatic vessels, they set their sights upon the idyllic location where the shop now resides. Unfortunately, a little hamburger concern known as McDonald's had also just plied their troth to the landowner to build a restaurant complete with a drive-thru. Eventually, the discerning residents of Vineyard Haven, who counted among their number some luminaries of literature, entertainment, and politics, came to the rescue and crushed the burger chain's dreams, leaving the property available to house the Marine Railway. If only all communities could be so sensible. Wooden boat shop or McDonald's? Think carefully, America. According to Nat, people had always told them they were crazy to specialize in wooden boats when fiberglass hulls were all the rage, not to mention cheaper to mold and maintain than wooden watercraft. Fortunately, Nat and Ross knew intrinsically that despite the superficial advantages of a plastic boat, it just didn't feel as good as wood. It's like swinging a plastic baseball bat, or in my opinion, reading a book on a tablet versus holding the real thing in one's hands. Sure, the newer model has its selling points, but the convenience can't outweigh the solidity and presence of reading off the page for me. I asked Nat himself why one should choose wood over any synthetic hull, and his answer was most satisfying. "Sailing a wooden boat is a symphony of sound above and below deck as the sea rushes by. She also talks to you, a creak here, maybe a groan or two when driven hard. The glow of varnish, salted down wooden decks, bronze patina, and the structural timbers and fine joinery. All the lovely details give us a visual feast of grace and beauty. And a wooden boat smells so good." There's an important distinction to be made here. The people who inspire me never seem to be looking to maximize profits. They have an understanding that life's rewards are to be found much more in the difference between sanding, say, white oak, and sanding fiberglass and epoxy. Interestingly, these artisans and free thinkers still manage to lead a life of richness and sometimes even prosperity. I must admit that the more my wood shop relegates itself to solid wood craftsmanship versus fabricating cookie-cutter items out of man-made wood products like medium-density fiberboard, the better we seem to feel. Of course, in Nat's case, he happens to carry on board a surplus of immense artistic talent to back up his skills on the spokeshave. While the boat shop houses an ever-shifting roster of craftspeople, joiners, caulkers, sailmakers and riggers, welders and carvers, There is an arcane skill that must come into play before any of these other talents can be employed, that of lofting. Lofting is the term to describe how a hull's shape is described by means of its lines. If you can imagine the lines of latitude and longitude on a globe, and then apply similar lines of sectioning to the shape of a boat, these are the lines with which lofting concerns itself. Enjoyably, the corresponding lines on the curving slanted stern or rear of the vessel are known as buttock lines, which goes a long way towards explaining why your average wooden boat is rocking such a sweet caboose. I could spend an entire chapter describing the process, and you would be asleep by the first sentence, so let me try and nutshell it for you. First of all, Nat has to bring his historical knowledge of boat shapes to bear upon his imagination. This is the culmination of centuries of design, making improvements incrementally, builder by builder, across different cultures and different types of sea, river, or lake, until by now the craft has achieved a relative ideal. Nat understands how the shape and the weight of the hull relate directly to its performance and durability. Bear in mind that there are zero straight lines on this complex shape, and every piece will be made of wood in a way that it will keep the water on the outside, with any luck. As he says, a boat is a piece of furniture you take out on the ocean and throw around. Once he has conceived the general design, he sketches it out, and if it's a commission, he then discusses it with his client until everyone is happy with the concept. At this point, the lofting begins. Determining a series of those segmenting globe lines using math and apparently sorcery, Nat then transfers those lines full size onto an open floor, from which the shape and dimensions of each individual part of the ship can then be determined. Despite Nat's humility in this area, he is truly considered one of the greatest living wooden boat designers. To say that his craft involves an element of sorcery is actually an understatement. Combine that nuanced ability with the manner in which he and Ross Gannon seem equipped to solve any problem whatsoever that can be solved by tools, elbow grease, a hunk of mahogany, and an inbred understanding of simple machines, and you have the makings of the finest wooden boats that money can buy. Mr. Nat Benjamin grew up in the small Hudson River town of Garrison, New York, and vacationed at the Pleasant Bay Camp on Cape Cod, where he fell in love with sailing the 18-foot Bay Bird, designed by W. Starling Burgess. He was destined for a life on the open water, and his passion eventually found him crewing boats up and down the Atlantic seaboard, until at age 20, an offshore delivery took him to the Virgin Islands. It was there, at St. Thomas, that his eyes feasted upon a fleet of old wooden masterpieces, from the drawing boards of Alden and Harrishoff, Sparkman and Stevens, Fife, Camper and Nicholson, and Rhodes, noted virtuosos from the golden age of yacht design. Beyond the hypnotizing lines of their boats, Nat was also taken in by the people who owned and sailed them. They were crazy, but in a good way. They knew how to get the most out of life. Called upon to skipper the delivery of such fine wooden yachts across the open Atlantic and back, between the Mediterranean, the Caribbean, and the American East Coast, a young Nat Benjamin grew to thrive on such adventure. Returning in a ship from Malta on one such voyage, Nat found his boat in bad shape. It was what they called a sinking feeling. So he pulled ashore in North Africa for repairs, and these guys were good. We ripped off some planks and replaced them, and that's when I first became fascinated by the work of the shipwrights. Jimmy, Taylor, and I understand, as we were then flatly astonished when we cruised across the road to the larger build shed, in the yard of which were several boats being stored for the winter, including sloop Sally May, Nat's first design, built for James Taylor in 1980. Inside, there was a Harrishoff yacht from 1905, undergoing pretty intensive repairs, which I would normally have considered a massive job had it not been dwarfed next to an enormous Hong Kong schooner built in 1957 to a Sparkman and Stevens design. The vessel was stripped down to the frames and planks of the hull, and it was mind-boggling as Nat walked us through each piece of the puzzle and how it would fit back together. That's always an important key for me. When I consider any project impossible, I first consider the fact that, well, somebody has done this already, so it can be done. Then I remember the advice of Ted Moores, my teacher in canoe craft. You don't have to build the whole boat at once. You just have to make the first piece, and then you make the second piece, and so on. Still in all, this stem-to-stern overhaul that Nat was undertaking would make a grown man weep, even perhaps a grown woman. We asked Nat what price an overhaul like this would run a person, to which he replied, about $1 million. As we stood, blinking and nodding, with false understanding, as though we hadn't just shit ourselves, he continued, that's considerably cheaper than building new. Okay, so wooden boats aren't the cheapest investment out there, but then when I stack it up against a wooden slab dining table from my shop that goes for $10,000, it seems rather a bargain. The table has maybe 10 parts, and most of that price is the labor and the cost of a large slab of tree, usually around $2,000 or $3,000. A boat certainly has more than 100 times as many parts, all of them curved. In boat building, fine furniture making, and home building, if anybody's getting rich, it's generally not the men and women swinging the mallets. So what is it that drives these goofy boat builders, if not the almighty dollar? Part of it for Nat is simply knowing that he and his shopmates do things in the best possible way they can be done. Their techniques may be centuries old, but they're becoming largely lost to us in this modern era of mass production and computer-generated 3D printing. On top of which, he told us that with old boats, it was just worth it to some people to maintain a masterfully built classic, rather than spend that fortune on something new. His theory is not at all unlike the way Thomas Lee Nielsen makes his tools. It is the adherence to the importance of quality in all parts of life, I feel, that protects us from the creeping tentacles of consumerist thought. Nat described to us the technique of steaming wood so that large planks can be bent around the curves of a hull. In a long box, large enough to encompass the plank, steam is pumped from any primitive kettle arrangement. Steam is easy to make. And the wood is steamed for 1 hour per inch of thickness. Nat was talking about a clipper ship, the Charles W. Morgan, which had recently taken skilled wrights 7 years to rebuild at Mystic Seaport. The planks on her were 3.5 inches thick and 40 feet long, which means they would require 3.5 hours in the steam box. So many skills have been totally lost, he went on. I mean, they used to build clipper ships much bigger than that up and down the coast here. In every backwater creek, they used to crank those things out in 90 to 100 days. From lofting to launching, finished. What people do these days is a joke compared to the work Harrishoff did on his yachts. We spoke further of the dearth of valuation for hand skills in today's society, and what a destructive and dangerous attitude that is. Nat described the joyful sight of seeing the native children in third world situations strip a palm leaf of its fronds, leaving a paddle-shaped stem, jump into a dugout canoe crafted by their fathers, and paddle into the ocean with aplomb, as happy as clams at high tide. One of the most inspiring books I've read on the topic of such lost skills is John McPhee's The Survival of the Bark Canoe, which details a young Maine man's quest to keep alive the noble Native American craft of building a perfect canoe with only ingenuity, a knife, a match, and products that one can glean from the woods. I think that part of what defines gumption involves a willingness, even a hunger, for one's mettle to be challenged. Just like Wendell Berry, Nat finds no use for a computer in his work, especially when it comes to designing and lofting, even though most modern designers have switched to CAD programs. The familiar note here seems to be that people with gumption will bristle when less is required of them. A part of human nature tends towards laziness and comfort, which is the part being so lucratively exploited by corporations, but there is a more noble part. The portion of the human spirit that revels not in ease, but in having its capabilities tested. These estimable characters know the profoundest, bone-deep satisfaction of having themselves challenged by the world and relying only upon their human capabilities, their gumption. They not only win the contest, but they infuse those around them with the inspiration to shine as well. Nat pilots sail-powered boats across the ocean, navigating primarily with the celestial bodies and a sextant. He and Ross and their boatyard have produced more than 60 substantial vessels, most of them born of his pencil, not to mention a veritable fleet of smaller craft. He holds a license from the U.S. Coast Guard to captain a ship up to a weight of 100 tons. Standing in his chilly shop in December, surrounded by all the tools and sawdust, Nat Benjamin said to me with a slight grin, "I find that I have friends that are retiring, and I think, gosh, have they had such lousy work that they want to retire? If they told me I couldn't go to work, I'd be pretty upset." Echoing the subjects of so many previous chapters, Wendell Berry, Eleanor Roosevelt, Benny Frankel's, if you don't love your work enough to have a good time doing it, then maybe you're showing up at the wrong job. Nat Benjamin, most assuredly, is not. Chapter 15. The Woodworker. George Nakashima. "Hey, look, it's a Japanese-American. And his redoubtable daughter, Mira. That's a Japanese-American woman." Talk about the American dream. George Nakashima was born in 1905 in Spokane, Washington, home of the best boot company, White's Boots, made in America, the 100% kind. To a newspaper reporter descended from samurai lineage named Katsuharu Nakashima, and his wife Suzu, qualifying him from the get-go as an heroic American citizen. Boom. A bright young pisser, George graduated from the University of Washington with a bachelor's degree in architecture in 1929, then went on to earn his master's degree from MIT in 1931. He moved to New York City and worked as a mural painter and architectural designer. Bingo. Feeling pretty tall, he hopped a ship to France, where he undoubtedly ate the hell out of some crepes and snails, while kicking about the country for a year like a hotshot young American architect. His tour continued to North Africa and finally Japan, where he got a job with an American architect, Antonin Raymond. In 1937, George volunteered to design and supervise the construction of a religious sanctuary in Pondicherry, India, where he underwent a deep transformation of consciousness, so profound that he was given the Sanskrit name Sundarananda, which means one who delights in beauty. Bango! Nakashima's work thereafter was inculcated with a religious zeal, even as he created his first furniture for the ashram dormitory. He believed that it was necessary to remove the desire to promote one's individual ego from the creative process, and to devote work each day to the divine. A notion quite contrary to Western culture, but one that would inspire him to great heights nonetheless. Bongo. Returning to Japan, young George canvassed the island nation, absorbing the subtly alluring details of traditional Japanese architecture, and met Marion Okajima, also born in America, who would become his wife. Walking tall, eh, what, Georgie? A groovy Sanskrit name and a foxy bride on top of a winning disposition and a surplus of talent for design? The Lovebirds moved to Seattle and opened a furniture workshop in 1940, and Marion gave birth to a beautiful daughter, Mira, in January of 1942, and everything was peachy keen. Sound of tires screeching to a stop. Oh. Dang. Pearl Harbor. You youngsters may not be hyper-aware of this little speed bump in our great nation's track record regarding civil liberties, but if you'll recall from Chapter 7, when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, old FDR pooped his presidential drawers and, under the pressure of his advisors, issued Executive Order 9066, which yanked about 120,000 Japanese-Americans from their mostly West Coast homes and plunked them unceremoniously into concentration camps. "Say what?" you say. "That is accurate reporting," I reply. "No shit?" you add. "That's a negatory on the shit," I persever. "That is fucked up," you conclude. You don't say. Read on. This next part is juicy and shameful. We, white folks, tossed the Japanese into camps, despite the fact that 2/3 of them were U.S. citizens like the Nakashimas. This action was undertaken out of sheer racism and fear. Classic white guy move. We tucked the Orientals out of sight just to be on the safe side while we were firebombing Japanese cities in preparation for a massive attack of the Allied forces on Japan. Remember, this is mere decades after the Yellow Peril was the commonplace term for our civilization's fear of some sort of Asian invasion. World War II, to me, is best represented by a group of boys of varying races playing with their toy guns on a playground. They are shooting and seriously wounding one another, taking sides with their allies, and seeing who will dare to push the game the furthest. One kid with a weird tiny mustache is playing like an asshole, like he owns the playground, so he is subdued, and it seems like things are going to wind down, except that Japanese kid is refusing to give up. He lands a couple of good shots on the American kid, just on his elbow, but still it smarts. So the American kid pulls out a nuclear bomb and nukes the Japanese kid. The playground is stunned. Nothing remains of the victim but a white shadow on the side of the school building. Like it or not, if you end a war by being the biggest asshole by far, you are not really a victor. You're the biggest asshole who had the last word, and the reason nobody retaliated is not because the other nations think America is the best. It's because there's not another world power willing to be such a dick on the playground. Knee-jerk patriots who proclaim our country's obvious superiority are ignorant to the fact that while we are indeed superior, it's actually as bullies that we have established our dominance. The manifest destiny was our nation's presumptive attitude in expanding west across the continent, with the absurd aim of democratic conquest, declared by us justifiable based upon our virtue. You ask, but who could bestow such a privilege upon this particular group of white people? Why, the answer is God, of course. That's the Christian God, the same white-bearded fellow who approves of our playground diplomacy in the Middle East. For how much difference is there, really, between the Yellow Peril and the Muslim Terror? The same deity, we were told, by George W. Bush, that put George W. Bush in the White House, despite his losing the election. A miracle indeed. I really like the teachings of Jesus, by the way. They are beautiful and profound and morally unimpeachable. I only wish, like Wendell Berry, that so many of these gosh darn Christians felt the same way. Mr. Berry is classy and respectable, and I admire him powerfully. But he's not here right now, so I'm going to go ahead and assert that the vast number of Americans who claim to follow Christ and yet support actions like our imperialistic tendencies, including slavery, internment camps, sounds more gentle than concentration, genocide, police actions, torture, and collateral damage, well, you're clearly full of shit. Now, let's talk about a goddamn nice furniture maker. Despite their lemony incarceration at the hands of their cool white captors and fellow Americans, the Nakashimas made lemonade quite handily. While imprisoned, George met and began to assist Gentaro Hikogawa, a fellow inmate who was trained in traditional Japanese joinery. This style of joinery employs no fasteners, relying instead upon cleverly mating puzzle-like components that are designed to remain dependably conjoined for as long a time as the wood timbers themselves do. Once again, we are presented with a discipline that chooses beauty, quality, and patience over speed and profit. Nakashima wrote, "The decline in quality of modern furniture is probably due in part to the use of the quick, easy, and cheap dowel joint. The decline of modern domestic architecture can be traced to the popularity of the stud wall put together with hammer and nails, a type of construction calling for no joinery at all. By contrast, the early American house and barn with their excellent joinery still represent the best we have produced and will greatly outlast contemporary buildings." Nakashima took to this ancient joinery style like a televangelist to your grandmother's pension dollars, and when his family was sprung from the Idaho camp, after being sponsored by their white pal, Antonin Raymond, they set up a home in New Hope, Pennsylvania, where Raymond lived. The young family had to start over very much from scratch, and they spent a rough couple of winters getting their domicile together, literally stacking the stones from the property into walls. It wasn't long before George was crafting what would become his signature style of sculptural tables, chairs, benches, and cabinets in his Pennsylvania studio. The Nakashima table style can best be described as employing a large slab of wood made from one vertical slice of the tree, which has been flattened and smoothed on its faces, but retains the organic, natural outer edges. In the beginning, he used no power tools, mostly because there was no power. As a purist student trying to emulate his work, I always felt conflicted when employing electricity upon any step of a Nakashima piece until I read this: "As much as man controls the end product, there is no disadvantage in the use of modern machinery, and there is no need for embarrassment. A power plane can do in a few minutes what might require a day or more by hand. In a creative craft, it becomes a question of responsibility, whether it is a man or the machine that controls the work's progress." Boy, that was good news. I was further tickled to discover that George would drive a couple of large screws up through the bottom of his tabletops into each wing of the famous butterfly keys that he installed along cracks or seams. Screws! He applied his philosophy of gentle curiosity to the wood, revering the material with a most Eastern sensibility. "I have always been interested in meditation and mysticism," he said. "I think I've always been that kind of seeker. But I am also Japanese enough and pragmatic enough to want to give this spirit physical expression." I suppose I can't blame him for citing his Japanese heritage after being, you know, thrown into a concentration camp with his wife and infant daughter. But I hope that we Americans can evolve our country into some place where George would not mind flying his flag. We certainly have a long way to go. In a 1962 manifesto, George said this: "In proportion to the flood of consumer goods, we are probably at one of the lowest ebbs of design excellence that the world has seen. It requires a genuine fight to produce one well-designed object of relatively permanent value." Now, listener, I'll let you figure out if we've improved matters since then or if we've made them worse. If you need to hunt for the answer, you'll want to dig up your passport, because the information you seek lies in China, and at the headquarters of IKEA and Walmart, as well as piled up for your ready research in the stacks, by which I mean the landfills around the globe. For me, one of the most appealing attributes of Nakashima's ethos is that it requires a slow approach. If you are one man or woman attempting to make wooden implements that patrons will desire, then it does little good to build a plain bench or table, exactly like something that could be purchased more cheaply from a mass manufacturer. By using an entire slice of a tree, one creates a singular sculptural work of art that transcends the mere notion of table and becomes something more. With such work, one is literally suggesting that we choose beauty in nature over industrial produce, that we rise above the human weakness that causes things like internment camps. As George put it, in a world where manual skills are shunned, we believe in them, not only in the act of producing a better product, but in the sheer joy of doing or becoming. Despite the success and acclaim he received, he strove to keep his shop from growing. He insisted that he and his fellow woodworkers maintain their focus on quality and pure artistry, never quantity. The popularity of his furniture grew incrementally, servicing neighbors and more distant customers alike, like the parents of Michael Pollan. Until 1973, when New York Governor Nelson Rockefeller ordered 200 pieces for his new house in Pocantico Hills, New York. From that point on, Nakashima's work began to be highly collectible and is now gracing many major museum collections around the world. I reckon gumption, then, in the case of George Nakashima, would be located in his ability to bear the indignities and damages inflicted upon him by the sad white people whom he only wanted the right to call neighbor. To look inside himself and the trees beneath his hands and find a deliverance to a more peaceful life. In 1981, George published his book, The Soul of a Tree, which instantly became required reading for any aspiring woodworker. In this gorgeous book, dripping with his philosophy and his work in equal parts, he wrote that he strove to discover each wooden slab's ideal use, to create an object of utility to man, and, if nature smiles, an object of lasting beauty. George passed away in 1990 at 85 years of age, but his charismatic daughter, Mira, has taken up the mantle of the craft to continue his life's work without abatement. The studio is still turning out work as gorgeous as ever to this day, if not more so, since it now has gained the advantage of a woman's perspective. Speaking of her own assistant, Miriam Carpenter, Mira said, "She's been with us for 6 years, basically doing what I did for 2 decades, being the understudy. With one big difference. When I did a drawing that Dad didn't like, he would just go in and change it. When I feel I need to change something, I explain why. I am thus delighted to discern a gorgeous vein of gumption running through the George Nakashima Woodworker Studios even now." Chapter 16. The Jester, Carol Burnett. The thing about Carol Burnett is, she's kind of a goddess. There'll be some of you younger types who may not be as familiar with her variety program, The Carol Burnett Show, which ran for only 11 years from the late 60s into the late 70s. So I would suggest you treat yourself to some of those on the YouTube. Once you've committed to your viewing, however, do be prepared to cut yourself off cold turkey, as the typing in of that show's particular moniker produces a staggering 166,000 results, many of them full episodes, of which they made some 278-odd. Mind this rabbit hole of raillery. It is rather bottomless, and your sides may actually split should you fail to heed my counsel. Rib-tickling to the point of bruises is guaranteed. I arrived at her lovely home near Santa Barbara, California, to pick her up for lunch. I had met her twice before, once when she was a guest on my wife's talk show, and once when we sat together at a Broadway play, and she had already set me at ease by treating me like family from the get-go, She has the generous ability to make everyone she meets feel like they're the apple of her eye. Regardless, I was nervous to spend time with her on my lonesome, because I can be clumsy. She let me in the front door, a French oak with copper details, and bid me wait while she fetched her purse. I looked to my right and noticed the door to the powder room, upon which was the sort of sign plaque that would normally read restroom or lavatory. Carol's read, "Euphemism." My tension left me immediately. She has won accolades for decades, or decaccolades, if you insist, and much has been justly made of her ridiculous comedy chops. She has been as good at winning laughter and awards as my beloved Chicago Cubs have been at not winning pennants, a tall tally of praise indeed. Just wait till next year, you son of a bitch. So many laurels have been wreathed about her comedy offerings, I fear that another most significant virtue has been sorely overshadowed. Carol Burnett is foxy. Sure, she makes me laugh. I am a human mammal, which is the only requisite to finding her hilarious to the point of leaving couch puddles. But her face and body language also contain such a surplus of heart and earnest. Her smile, such a proliferation of beauty, and her fulsome songbird's voice, when not mangled for a laugh, such a bewitching lilt that I must confess I have been in love with her for 40-some years. There have been other great beauties in my life, sure, and funny ladies? Shucks, I've been lucky enough to befoul quality programs lousy with them. Nonetheless, Carol somehow combines her self-deprecating charm with a natural charisma that makes her the queen of the bunch. Lest I be suspected of infidelity, I should reveal that my wife Megan feels much the same as I. In point of fact, Carol has politely but firmly declined our 17 entreaties, as of this recording, to join us in a three-way. Not to mention, she got there decades before the funny ladies to whom I now bow, establishing herself as an intrepid pioneer in a field where few ladies had been allowed to do more than possess bosoms. Gilda Radner, Catherine O'Hara, Molly Shannon, Lisa Kudrow, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, Amy Poehler, Tina Fey, Melissa McCarthy, Rachel Dratch, Kristen Wiig, and now Jenny Slate and Ellie Kemper are all luminaries who have followed in Carol's footsteps from the world of sketch comedy to the top of Showbiz Mountain, to paraphrase Ms. Poehler. On top of her legendary comedy program and her extensive work in film and on Broadway, not to mention a veritable Thanksgiving feast-level grocery list of awards, Golden Globes, Emmys, People's Choice Awards, and many others. A menu long enough that you had best fix yourself a sandwich if you want to settle in for a scroll down her IMDb page. Carol Burnett has also published 3 best-selling books. So pervasively is her mojo working that not only did she receive the 2013 Mark Twain Prize for American Humor and the Kennedy Center Honors in 2003, but she was also awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 2005. When I look back at the aplomb with which she delivered all her delicious performances, the decorum with which she comports herself when not on stage, and all the gales of laughter with which she and her partners in comedy caused our house to be filled, I am inclined to imagine Ms. Burnett as one of those lifelong champion types, the kind of person who wins the preschool lemonade fundraiser, who earns every scouting badge until they make her up a new badge simply for badge earning, and who mercilessly dominates the 7th grade spelling bee. In Manuka, she was called Tracy Lalonde. It's easy, then, to imagine my surprise when I learned that, on the contrary, she had a pretty traumatic childhood, raised primarily by her mother's mother on relief in a low-rent Hollywood apartment. That fact makes all the more impressive the demeanor of elegance and class she has effortlessly maintained throughout her career, even while falling down a set of stairs. Her folks were both plagued by alcoholism, starting with her dad when she was just a wee girl in San Antonio. Her mom and dad had aspirations of making it in Hollywood, so they moved to Los Angeles, where they ended their marriage and divorce and unloaded young Carol on her grandmother, although her mother still lived down the hall from them. Burnett said that her mother would get mean under the influence of drink, so young Carol took to hiding herself behind a screen and drawing, while her mother and grandmother had it out. For a time, she thought she might even pursue a career in drawing, perhaps aspiring to one day illustrate fairy tale books. Comedy is often the best therapy, however, and so it's no surprise that Carol's famous Eunice character bore some strikingly similar elements to her mother during these fits of rancor. At Hollywood High School, Burnett did perform in some school dramatics, but nothing caught fire, and so she found herself drawn more to her job editing the Hollywood High newspaper. Finally, at UCLA, majoring in theater and English because they had no journalism program, she found herself thrust reluctantly on stage in a required freshman acting class. Cast as a hillbilly, she reached into her heretofore untested bag of tricks and let rip with a lengthily drawled, "I'm back!" Well, the audience, as hers tend to do, erupted in laughter, and just like that, everything changed. According to Carol, "All of a sudden, after so much coldness and emptiness in my life, I knew the sensation of all that warmth wrapping around me. I had always been a quiet, shy, sad sort of girl, and then everything changed for me. You spend the rest of your life hoping you'll hear a laugh that great again." She became obsessed with performing and writing for the theater. Her newfound acumen on stage made her popular on campus, an entirely new sensation in her life. Teenage singing sessions, harmonizing with her grandmother and mother, who would also play the ukulele, had revealed to her that she had a strong leading voice. After a few years at UCLA, armed with this arsenal of talents and a satchel full of gumption, she lit out east for the territory of Broadway, figuring on stage would be where her best shot at success resided. This plan did not align with that of Carol's mother. "She wanted me to be a writer. She said, 'You can always write, no matter what you look like.' When I was growing up, she told me to be a little lady, and a couple of times I got a whack for crossing my eyes or making funny faces." In this one formative anecdote, strongly smacking of Eleanor Roosevelt, Carol was told that she didn't have the looks to succeed as a beauty, even as she was stockpiling the clown's ammunition she would eventually come to brandish in her lifelong campaign to make us smile. She made it to New York, took a room in a boarding house for aspiring actresses, and got a menial job as a hat check girl. After a slow first year, she began scoring appearances on a couple of different children's and variety television shows. Burnett even did a season on Buddy Hackett's short-lived sitcom, Stanley, playing his girlfriend, but when the show got canned, it was back to the hustle for her. She spent a couple summers working the Adirondacks vacation circuit, which turned out to be a great boon, as she and her community of talented cut-ups were able to hone their skills and workshop their sketch ideas before presenting them in the big city. It's worth noting that throughout her 20s, despite her enormous talent, Carol Burnett really had to bust her hump. "I am always hugely inspired and personally relieved to learn of the hard work that was required of any of my heroes before they could arrive at the level of mastery for which they ultimately garnered renown. Not to mention the redoubled sweat it cost them to maintain said level." I copped this axiom from Tom Waits' toothsome-cut Little Man, but apparently the Roman philosopher Seneca was first credited with, "Luck is when opportunity meets with preparation." And Carol was loading her plate with a healthy serving of just that. Preparation. The opportunity part came into play with resultant luck in tow when she scored the lead in the Broadway musical Once Upon a Mattress in 1959, a show that had been workshopped in the Adirondacks. Since When It Rains, It Pours, she was then simultaneously hired to work as a regular on The Gary Moore Show, a live television variety program that she would shoot live on Fridays before hustling over to her 8 p.m. performance of Mattress. She was nominated for a Tony for the Broadway musical, and 2 years later won an Emmy for the TV show. Not a bad stretch for a young charwoman yet to see her 30th birthday. Sitting at lunch with Carol Burnett on a beautiful Southern California afternoon, my head was swimming a bit with a heavy dose of, how the hell did I get here? Hearing her first-person account of hijinks from the set of her show, and imagining her and Tim Conway and Harvey Korman and the rest trying to get through some of those live sketches with a straight face was the most delicious part of the meal. As we ventured into her earlier history, Carol unfolded a couple of anecdotes that I can't help but pass along. First, while working on The Gary Moore Show, a junior writer she called Doc Simon, Neil Simon, wrote a sketch called Playhouse 90 Seconds, a send-up of the popular Playhouse 90 dramatic television series. As she describes it, Durward Kirby was in a hospital bed with his head bandaged. I'm his wife or whatever, and he's a doctor. I say, how are you, darling? Oh, Jill, I don't feel too well. And I say, oh, Jack, why'd you have to go up the hill? And he said, well, I just felt I should fetch a pail of water. Look what happens. And then Gary Moore comes in and says, it's not good. What are you going to do, Jill? I say, well, I'll just go tumbling after. And then I dived out of a window. So the producer said, do you know how to dive out of a window, Carol? I said, oh, sure, no problem. We're getting on the set during blocking, and so I didn't know what I was going to do. I just knew I was going to sail out of that window. I said, well, I'll just go tumbling after. Went out, and I landed on a mattress. And I sat up and said, oh, gosh, guys, thanks for the mattress. I guess I thought I was just going to go splat. I didn't even think to check. The second story, Carol's double schedule, and Once Upon a Mattress, and then rehearsing and performing on Gary Moore, left her with only Monday nights off. The musical, based upon the Hans Christian Andersen story, The Princess and the Pea, requires the princess, Carol, to try and go to sleep on a pile of mattresses. Even though she had the bloom of youth on her side, the heavy workload still caught up with her during one Sunday matinee, and she was out like a light. She thinks she must have been asleep for only 20 or 30 seconds before the stage manager was able to awaken her with panicked whispers. The moral of the story is either too much gumption can land you in trouble with Actors' Equity, or the employment of gumption requires adequate rest, at the risk of great peril to the gumptionator. It never occurred to me to be cynical. I didn't know that I couldn't do certain things, so I did them. Carol Burnett said that of the pluck it must have taken to pull off this seemingly impossible schedule. Ignorance can indeed lead to bliss. I said that. She struck up a lifelong friendship with Julie Andrews, another fervid boyhood crush of mine, when Andrews guested on Gary Moore. In 1962, the pair of luminous ladies appeared in a television special together, Julie and Carol at Carnegie Hall. The two had such a magical appeal together, like perhaps a young Aubrey Plaza and Amy Adams, if you combined them with Bambi. Nonetheless, the typical CBS executives were initially reluctant to greenlight the idea, as they believed Andrews was not sufficiently famous, and what with Burnett's weekly presence on Moore's show, the public would not be excited enough to tune in. Until one night after a CBS promotional event, when Burnett was unable to hail a taxi. The executives in question offered to wait until she was safely away, but Burnett told him not to bother because a truck driver would appear shortly to pick her up. Almost at once, a trucker screeched up and did just as she'd predicted. Burnett received a telephone call from CBS immediately upon arriving home. Paying homage to her clear display of bewitchery, they approved the special, which went on to win an Emmy for both the show and Carol herself. The Secret. Despite her televised success in the variety format on The Gary Moore Show, Burnett kept thinking, I'm not really television, I really want to be Broadway. But the television became more fun for me because we still did music and we still had comedic sketches, with the advantage that it changed every week. So I was able to learn how to do different characters and to be different people, as opposed to being the same person on a sitcom every week or the same person 8 shows a week on Broadway. This was like doing a little Broadway review every single week, and that became what I liked the most because it gave me, as we say, variety. Meanwhile, she continued to knock down tall accomplishments like so many bowling pins as she befriended the likes of Ms. Andrews as well as Jim Nabors, Mike Nichols, and Lucille Ball. CBS signed her to a 10-year deal, and Lucy, an obvious mentor and producing magnate with her company Desilu Productions, offered Carol her own sitcom called Here's Agnes, which sounds like a pretty hilarious idea based solely upon imagining Burnett as any Agnes that might be presented so. The title almost carries with it an implied addendum, as in, Here's Agnes, good luck, or Here's Agnes, with apologies, or Here's Agnes, God love her. No matter how they might have played it, the idea was still born because Carol Burnett had her heart set on a sketch and variety show. CBS was not immediately sold on the idea, as they felt like this arena was not ideal for a person of Carol's gender. As she remembers, "Are you kidding? I was told by CBS that comedy variety shows were a man's game, that it was the domain of Sid Caesar and Milton Berle and Jackie Gleason." Nonetheless, she had a 30-week guarantee in her deal with the network to try out just such a show. So try it out she did, thank the sweet baby Jesus. This wasn't the first time Carol had run into staunch opposition on the basis of her gender. It's in that arena that I really sit up and notice her gumption. Burnett tells a story about having wanted... Scratch that. Having dreamed of attending UCLA, a sheer impossibility for her, as the tuition for one semester in 1951 ran to an exorbitant $43. She and her grandmother, existing on welfare, were paying $30 a month in rent, relegating her collegiate aspirations to the realm of fantasy. Her grandmother, with 6 marriages under her belt, suggested that she learn to be a secretary, and then you can nab the boss. Carol, unwilling to pursue her grandmother's questionable career advice, had no options, until she was astonished one morning to find a mysterious $50 bill in their pigeonhole mail slot. Apparently, somebody had thought she was worth a shot. Now, let's back up a second and renew our gaze upon our United States. You may or may not, I sincerely hope it's the former, have heard of a notion called the Equal Rights Amendment. To nutshell it for you, it was proposed in 1923, so almost 100 years ago.